The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. It's approaching 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 11th of September. You're very welcome along to the programme. We have a fantastic show lined up for you. We're going to reveal our four finalists for the Irish Month Music Awards too. We've got four brilliant acts which will be performing live on the show next week. That's coming up a little bit later on. We'll preview this week's podcast, and between now and then we've got our Friday panel. Just to invite you to get involved in the conversation, of course, 086 60 25000, that's the WhatsApp and the text number. Give us a call on 074 91 25000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. If you want to watch the show, get onto YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. You can watch on your smart TV and across your mobile devices. Or, in fact, you can watch on Facebook and on the X platform as well. Right, let's say good morning to Cathy Donaghy, author and journalist. Good morning, Cathy. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
Good, good, good. It's good to have you with us. Cian O'Hagan, chair of Ogra Sinn Féin in Donegal. Good morning, Cian.
Morning, Greg. Good to see you again.
Good to have you back on. And Seamus McDade, Managing Director of Football Special. Good morning, Seamus.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
Good, good, good. Just a brief recollection, if any of us have them. Cian, perhaps not. Cathy, 25 years since 9/11. Do you remember what you were doing, where you were that morning that we learnt that news?
I remember it so well, Greg. I actually had showed up for my shift in the Irish Independent. I was a reporter there, and old-fashioned newsrooms always had TVs and radios on. Mm. You know, it was sort of like the internet wasn't as big for things. So we had the tallies on up above the news desk. And I remember a colleague just saying, a plane has just flown into one of the Twin Towers. And we were like, what? Like, this is mad. And within, you know, a very short space of time, the second plane flew in, and we all just stood around the TV just watching this moment and thinking, what the hell is going on? Like, I mean, at the time it seemed this could not be a terrorist attack. That did not enter my head at that moment. It just did systems fail? What happened? But it was just, it was one of those things, I suppose, you never forget where you were. And then as the day went on, it became clear that this was something, you know, very wrong. And we know the fallout, what happened, and then watching just what unfolded as the day went on, it was absolutely heartbreaking.
I seem to recall it was my first sort of, I was in a small newsroom in Donegal Town at Northwest Radio at the time. Myself and my brother were working in there, watching it unfold. And then, funny, even back then, people from Ballyshannon who were there were calling in, and we were able to carry the coverage like that. But was that the first kind of big rolling news event? Or it's certainly one of the first I can remember, but that's, I suppose that's subjective, isn't it? But it was certainly one of the first big rolling news events that I can recall, you know, where the 24/7 news cycle, where the 24 news channels sort of come into prominence for me anyway. And I know other stations switched to it, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, and in a very cynical way, you know, it was the kind of event that just, you know, there were so many constant updates, you know. And I mean, obviously there have been incredibly awful terrorist events in the world since then, but I think you're right. It was one of those events where people were just glued, and they wanted updates, and they wanted to know what was happening, and a step by step and I think, you know, even now, even to this day, all these years later, stories are still emerging about, and you know what the beauty of this is? I think what's emerging now is the heroes, you know, the unsung, the little things that people did to help one another, even in the face of the worst of times, the human spirit emerged. And those are the stories that we're remembering now, especially on anniversaries. And, you know, we saw the film about, you know, the firefighters and the heroes, and, you know, Bruce Springsteen's, you know, immortalized this in those firefighters in song. So I think that there's a sense of, we remember now the courage of the human spirit against the most awful happening.
Yeah. Seamus, do you have any clear recollections of that time?
Yeah, well, I was the first year in secondary school, so I probably didn't really grasp the severity of it at the time. But I've since spent the guts of a decade living in New York. I'm married to a New Yorker, and it's only really when you go there you really grasp, you know, the hugeness of the event. And My mother-in-law had a cousin, firefighter Michael Lynch, who was killed that day. And, you know, the huge impact that his legacy has had in my in-law's family. And, you know, what's striking is that he was a man born in Queens, New York, to four Irish-born grandparents. Mm. So, you know, the impact that the Irish emigrants had in the FDNY and then what the FDNY had to suffer that day is probably really, you know, strikes home to put an Irish spin on the event. But, yeah, it's funny when you go. I remember when I first went there on the 10-year anniversary, and they do a thing where they read out all the names on TV. And, I mean, this thing takes, like, 4 hours. I remember leaving the office and coming back in, and it's probably only then when you're like, they're still reading out names.
Yeah.
This, you know, there's so many people passed away, and it was such an awful, awful event. And, yeah, it's just, yeah, it's hard to believe it was 25 years ago. Mm.
Cian, you obviously have zero recollection of it. You're under 25, are you?
Yes, naturally. I'll blame my youth for that, Greg.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's an interesting element to it because you're reflecting on it sort of as a historical moment, whereas the other three of us, me and Cathy, I think in particular, were sort of working at that time in news. With the security operation for Donald Trump's visit and golf trip projected to cost us, the taxpayer, €20 million, making it one of the most expensive security deployments in the state history, at what point does the cost of hosting a head of state who mixes private business with official engagements outweigh any diplomatic or economic justification for Ireland? Cian O'Hagan.
Well, first and foremost, before I would even analyse the economic impairments that it reflects on Ireland, I would say that it's a damning indictment on this current government to be doing business, never mind having a political correspondence with an individual like Donald Trump, considering his political record. On the anniversary of 9/11, and we're looking at a US president that has no impulse control, that has plunged the world into an economic crisis completely unnecessarily. And now we have a Fianna Fáil Taoiseach with a shady record at best when it comes to dealing with diplomats and US correspondents, such as Donald Trump. And we're looking at a complete oversight and complete insensitivity to the current economic impairments facing Ireland.
Cian, can I say, though, this is the joy of opposition, isn't it? Because Mary Lou McDonald, if she was Taoiseach, would be standing there in reality, even though members like yourself might not agree, she'd be standing there in reality shaking his hand and footing the bill. There's absolutely no way she would reject a visit from the President of the United States of America. How unsavoury a character you might believe him to be.
Well, hindsight's a wonderful thing, Greg, and I think as well, as a Sinn Féin member, I can say confidently, and my leader, my party's leader, that Mary Lou McDonald would have nothing to do with a US president like Donald Trump, someone with a record and a past as poor as his, as a political dialogue correspondent, as weak as his also. I mean, his cabinet are effectively leading this presidency for him. And it's a wonder now that on the back of his spiel yesterday about trying to afford American citizens $5,000 should they vote for the Republicans in the midterms and come the next election, the man is scrambling for support. And he knows he campaigned off no new wars. And yet he is sponsoring the state-sanctioned genocide by Israel of the Palestinian people, and has now plunged the world into a total unnecessary economic upturn.
Okay.
So Mary Lou McDonald would have anything to do with a man like Donald Trump is ludicrous.
Mm. I don't think that's actually necessarily a badge of honour, because I think even, you know, Sinn Féin supporters, you're among them, you're a member of it, might see that as a not a very positive move for Ireland, cutting ties with arguably our biggest one of our biggest connections in the world. Cathy Donaghy, what do you think?
You know, I'm so conflicted about this. I mean, I agree with a lot of what Cian said about Donald Trump. I'm certainly no fan of his. I do think that the government has to play, sort of has to walk a line here. America is still really, really important in terms of jobs. It's still really important in terms of industry. It's still really important in terms of global connections. I don't understand fundamentally how Donald Trump has not been, you know, reined in or dispatched, you know, by his own party, by the powers that be, but he hasn't. So he is serving some purpose for them, or he wouldn't still be around. To get back to the question, should we be footing the bill? You know, obviously it's standard practice that when a visiting dignitary comes here, they, you know, we look after security. This is not a purely business, or this is not a purely state visit. I mean, this is a golf weekend with the lads. You know, he's going down to Doonbeg to lord it over, and you know, it's going to be quite, I mean, puke-inducing to see what some of the scenes we'll see down there of his arrival. What I would say is, if anything happened to an American president on our watch, that would be unthinkable for us as a country. You know, it actually would, and the tide would turn very quickly on how something happened. So as much as the cost is, I think we've got to bear it. And because the alternative is unthinkable.
What do you think, Seamus McDade?
I do. I mean, I think we're all kind of in agreement that 99% of Irish people would be in opposition to Donald Trump's politics.
Do you think it's that high? I'm not sure it's that high, just because I know many people listening might disagree with you. But anyway, that's your view. Go on.
Well, I would say, but what I was going to say is that that's going to buy the buy, because he's the democratically elected president of the United States. So we are obliged to give him the requisite security measures. That being said, the government should be brave enough to stand up and say, well, a lot of this is not, you're not here on government business if you're visiting your private business operations in Doonbeg. However, I literally stopped at the petrol station in Ramelton on the way up the road this morning, and there was a carload of American Turk golfers filling up their car. Anybody who spent any time around Rossopenna will tell you it's full of American accents playing golf there. If we're quite happy to take their money when they spend money here, then we have to be prepared. The investment is that they see Doonbeg on the TV this weekend. They see Donald walking around claiming he's shooting a 62 around the golf course. That's the investment that the state has made to try and attract American tourism. So while the bill may seem hugely large, this is a thing that governments have to foot all over the world. I can remember my time in New York, an Irish minister coming there and him giving out to the concert that he wasn't allowed to take the subway because it was wasting his time. But he had to be driven around because the Secret Service were like, we're not letting an Irish government minister travel on the subway. So this happens all over the world. And we sort of have to park our personal feelings on Donald Trump.
Yeah, back to you, Cian. Like, I understand exactly where you're coming from, but I also understand the position that you can sort of speak from when you hear what Cathy had to say there, what Seamus has to say, the reality of, really, if Donald Trump took a notion what he could do to this corporation tax that we rely so heavily on, even though we shouldn't, you know, you really would have to be prepared to go all in if you were going to say, we're not doing business with you, sorry, you're not welcome.
No, well, I understand that, Greg. And I also understand the concerns from a financial standpoint in terms of the grip that America holds over the world, not just Ireland. But fundamentally, we're talking about corrupting our moral values in the face of dollars and pounds and euros. And in doing so, I think it's a reflection of the nature of this current government, a corporate capitalist government, that places financial incentives.
But what about the half of America that didn't vote for him? What about the 70% that don't approve of him now? What kind of a message does that send?
Well, it's an approval rate within America. And it's on top of that, I think, as I was going to say, it's a reflection on this Fianna Fáil government. And I think the one thing that they do have in common with Donald Trump is that financial incentives will always be prioritised above the needs of the working people. And I think, you know, Seamus talked about petrol stations. I think if you put on value, you know, American dollars coming into Ireland over humanitarian perspectives, then you're going down a very slippery slope. And people can say, well, Sinn Féin can sit in a comfortable seat as the opposition party and criticise these things. Sinn Féin are not anti-America. We are anti-Donald Trump. We are anti the war.
But how do we deal then? How do we deal then with Britain? How do we deal with Britain then, and the continued occupation of the six counties? How do we deal with the rest of the EU and, you know, much of its supporting to a great extent what Israel is doing, or certainly not doing enough to stop it. Like, where does it end? I mean, what?
Well, Sinn Féin is always resolute on its policy towards British involvement in Irish affairs. Sinn Féin supports resolutely, as it is the centrepiece of our manifesto, the end of British involvement in Irish political affairs through a border poll, through the consensus of the Irish people. There has been no consultation on this visit by Donald Trump to Ireland. And it's one to compare it to British involvement. Again, when you look at Britain's grip and the grip the British Empire held over hundreds of years across the world, and its record in this country, militarily and politically, it's a crying shame that any Irish Taoiseach would invite a man similarly of that.
What do you think of Mary Lou MacDonald attending funerals and shaking hands with the British King, with all that you've outlined there?
Well, the two are completely separate issues. England has a political grip, or has had a political grip over Ireland and over the occupied six counties for hundreds of years.
You said that, yeah. Well,
hold on, you've asked the question, Greg, so I'll give you a complete statement. There has to be an open dialogue with Britain, whether Irish people like it or not, whether Sinn Féin appreciates it or not. There has to be an open dialogue between the British government and Ireland if we are to secure a united Ireland. That's a fact. And you have to acknowledge that. What we don't have to accept and we don't have to acknowledge is a president like Donald Trump, who has zero impulse, zero control, and is sponsoring conflicts around the globe, as well as leading several of his own, after campaigning off the fact that in 2024 that he would never indulge in another conflict.
Okay, I appreciate what you say. It's a very tricky position to defend, I'll be completely honest with you, because, you know, we need the Americans as well to achieve what you're looking to achieve, as many of us are to achieve. But listen, I understand politics is complicated. Minister Jack Chambers announced on a podcast this week that he's stripping day-to-day finance autonomy from four regional health areas, including ours, the West and Northwest, this following hundreds of millions in overspends. Is this heavy-handed centralisation from Dublin a necessary emergency brake on runaway HSE spending and poor management? Or does stripping local control just punish regional health services for systemic structural flaws built into the actual health model itself? Cathy Donaghy, what do you think?
You know, when I read this, Greg, I just couldn't help but think, does the government actually want the health service to fail? We're scarcely 2 years of this so-called decentralisation programme, and yet they're reining them back in. But I actually think, and I was reading the comments, very strident comments of McLaughlin yesterday, and you know, there is a point here. We have an ageing population. We have we have had problems in the HSE and the health service for years. There doesn't seem to be a health minister, and Micheál Martin was in fact a health minister many years ago. Everybody who comes into health, every single minister is like, oh, they're going to bring this new broom and it's going to be sorted out. We don't seem to be able to sort out the health service. I feel like this is kind of optics. This to me just screams of optics. And Jack Chambers announced it on a podcast as well. You know, I just feel the whole thing is just really, this is the health service. It deserves more than announcing it, number one, or detailing it in a podcast. And I think if there's problems, bring people around the table. Surely there's a way to bring, you know, the number crunchers around the table. And of course, you know, there needs to be some kind of, you know, around the financial spending, there needs to be requirements. There needs to be good accountancy here, right? But given people 2 years and then said, okay, we're pulling it all back in, it seems like, what is happening? You know, it's like, try this, not working, short term, we'll try something else. I kind of feel, do they actually want to fail? We know that the health service is creaking. Anybody that visits A&E in Letterkenny and the amount of brilliant doctors and nurses there, I do not take away from them for one second. They're to the pin of their collars. But anybody that goes in there will tell you about the wait times, about the problems, about waiting to be seen. So I actually think, you know, this is window dressing and optics by the government.
Is this not taking control, though? Because the government can often be criticised for being hands-off. Like, we spend per patient 40% more than the EU average. 25% more than what they do in the UK. Now, I'm not saying any of their health services are perfect, don't get me wrong, but if we're spending 40% more per patient than the European average, and yet we have the health service that you described in your preamble to the comments that you got to, then is it not prudent for the person that holds those purse strings to pull it in and say, right, we need to figure out why this big spend is not delivering the output that it should?
Yeah, and you're right, Greg. I mean, we need to have strict financial controls. But within 2 years of decentralizing to rein it all back in, it smacks to me of they don't know how to fix this.
Seamus, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when there was the health boards, and then they centralized it with creating the HSE. Then they uncentralized it again 2 years ago, and they're centralizing it again. So it appears to me that it doesn't really matter where they spend the money. They just haven't really got a clue what they're doing. So, you know, I think Kathy is right. This is just optics. That being said, if any of the regional health boards were a beacon of good practice, then I would, and I am somebody who is very opposed to centralization, but it's hard to get too upset about them taking control back when, again, none of the regional health boards are doing an unbelievable job. Now, do I think it will get any better? Absolutely not, because it was centralized up until 2 years ago, and it was a mess. So we have huge systemic problems, but money in this scenario isn't the issue. Like you said, Greg, we spend 40% more than the EU average. The HSE has an equivalent budget to what NASA has, and this is what we're delivering. So money is not the limiting factor in this problem is not money. It is a want to try and make things get better. And for all my life, the government have not really tried to tackle this. I mean, Kathy is correct to say Micheál Martin was the Minister for Health. It seems like 150 years ago, and he wasn't able to fix it then. He's now the Taoiseach, and it's still in the same way it is now. So, you know, until the likes of Sláinte Care really gets up and going, or, you know, whatever sort of reform needs to happen within the health service, this is just sort of passing the buck between different places.
Like, we've a population of 5.5 million, and a budget of just the actual state healthcare, 27.4 billion. Really, we should be really at a great advantage. You know, we should be able to have, really, with that spend versus the population,
right,
an envious health service, surely, with the best outcomes in the world, because we're a big city across an entire country.
Right, and important to stress, we have one of the youngest populations in all of Europe. So by that nature, by that metric, our health spend should also be a lot lower than the rest of Europe because we have a younger population. But we've seen during COVID that we didn't have the paycheck, we didn't have the beds, all the lockdowns and things had to come in because we didn't have ICU capacity. Have we since COVID increased ICU capacity? No. So when the next pandemic comes, we'll be back to the same thing again because the government is not trying to make the issue any better.
Mm. Kieran O'Hagan, Chair of Ogra Sinn Féin in Donegal, what's your view?
Well, I think the one part of understanding I can afford, not to be lenient on the government's mismanagement here, is that I understand, as Kathy mentioned, there has to be some form of intervention in terms of managing funds because hundreds of millions can't be allowed to go to spare or be overspent, irrespective of there being an island-wide crisis. Now, given that fact, I think it's highly hypocritical for someone like Jack Chambers to criticise anyone, let alone the health department, on the mismanagement of funds. This is a man, you have to remember, that during the height of the fuel crisis and on St. Patrick's Day was on a €28,000 state-sponsored holiday in West Africa. Fair enough, he was promoting Irish economic incentives there. But for him to lecture the HSE on overspends and overdrafts and not being able to manage their budget efficiently, whilst he's lauding these figures from a private hotel, it's highly hypocritical.
Well, I understand where you're coming from, but perhaps a different example is the fact that centrally it is the government and the HSE responsible for the Children's Hospital, which has yet to be delivered, and they are the ones that are of the view that they can spend the money more efficiently.
Exactly, and we talk about the fact that Jack Chambers mentioned that money has to be saved and conserved more wisely so that it can be used elsewhere. And that would be fine if the government were proposing projects that were visible to the Irish people where this money was actually going. But when we look at other health incentives like the Children's Hospital that has been yet to be built and yet to be completed and has ended up spending millions more than what they initially intended, you have to wonder, like, where is the faith going to lie in the Irish people for the government to step in, reduce completely all forms of regional autonomy for healthcare centres and say, well, no, the money will be spent wisely elsewhere. When their record in health spending throughout the past decade has been horrific, to say the least. And you have to wonder as well when, as Seamus mentioned, ICU capacity has dramatically decreased. Our population is young, yes, but also our population of young nurses and medicine graduates and the rate at which they are leaving the country for greater financial ventures or more cost-effective financial ventures in Australia and elsewhere. This diaspora is evidence of the fact that the government is in no position to lecture anyone on financial mismanagement or at least on how to budget in the healthcare sector. They have no stand on.
Yeah, Cathy, it's part of the problem, though. You know, of the $27.4 billion that is spent, and there's additional funding coming from elsewhere too, but well over 60% of that's on staff and wages. Now, obviously, a lot of what hospital work is people working, right? It's not necessarily, but the point being is it reduces the headroom really for efficiency, doesn't it? Because you're dealing with well over 60% of your budget's on staff and wages, and you're dealing with unions and you're dealing with consultants, and you're is that part of the challenge, I wonder?
I think what the what seems to be at the crux of this whole issue, which, you know, they're now calling it back to the mothership, seems to be that on the one hand, while they were giving them greater autonomy and flexibility to manage their own houses, they are also, they're still very tight recruitment. So they're not really given the, you know, the organisations the chance to recruit as they need. And they're the ones who know the people that they need. So on one hand, the government is giving them this freedom, but on the other hand, they're taking it away, and now they're pulling it all back. And it's almost like, I feel that these constant changes of management structure, they just make things more difficult and they make things harder to fix.
Yeah, example of that was speaking to a senior anaesthetist at the hospital there recently, you know, talking about consultants on hospitals, but consultants in particular working 6 days instead of five. And the consultants can turn up on a Saturday, but they don't have all of the support staff that is required to actually function, because those staff have filled their hourly quota over the 5 days. So you give consultants this private-only, public-only contract, but you don't then give them the staff that is actually required to correctly function. It's very complicated, and I'm glad I don't have responsibility for it. A caller says the reason we're paying more for the healthcare is because of that stupid hospital, the most expensive building ever created, and it's taken longer than the pyramids to build. It's money that keeps sucking in more and more money. It's very hypocritical of the government to go, ooh, we have to take that money away from the regionals because they can't manage it. That's all BS, they say. I'm Donald Trump. Hi, Greg. I see Donald Trump's heading to Ireland to catch the golf instead of attending the 9/11 memorial, which will be attended by all living past presidents, all because he won't be allowed to speak. I'm sure he would have said 9/11 would never have happened if he was the president. And another, hi, Greg, in connection with Trump's attempted election rigging, the last time I heard that being done was in Colombia, and it was Pablo Escobar, the leader of a drug cartel. Really quite a remarkable commitment. If his party wins, he'll give every American adult €5,000. But we live in this strange world, Cathy, where it can just be said, and even though it can be fact-checked and it's not clear whether he'd get even his own party's support to spend $1.3 trillion buying an election. But it doesn't matter. There's nothing really you can say that's going to have any, or I could say, or any of us could say, that's like a gotcha, or say, point something out, because it's so blatantly crazy.
Yeah, I don't know what he needs to do. I mean, he could probably get away with murder at this stage, and people would say, you know, get over it. It's like we've sort of lost some our powers of remembrance. It's like something that happened yesterday or the week before that. It's like what's happening right now, and he's the living embodiment of that. He's like this. he just gets up out of bed and it's a new day and everything's in the past, everything's forgotten, and this kind of amnesia comes into society.
But even in Britain, like, say for instance, if it was 20 years ago, the exposés and the revelations about reform would have seen the Nigel Farage disappear from public life forever, would have seen the party obliterated. But it doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter.
We live in an age where people believe what they want to believe, and nothing will take them away from that.
It's interesting. Kian O'Hagan, the Taoiseach's warning that diesel and petrol prices staying above €2 a litre is likely to be a new norm due to the ongoing Middle East volatility, even as motorists were facing soaring home heating costs and looming protest pressures. The government effectively throwing in the towel on the cost of living relief, do you think, with those types of statements? Or, to be fair, are global oil shocks completely out of Dublin's hands?
Well, I would say not only in relation to fuel, Greg, this government threw in the towel a long time ago, even before the last election. But I would say, in fairness, to the statement with regards to Trump, the accountability lies, yes, at the greater world powers, and at the current economic crisis and the global crisis faced by fuel embargoes caused by the Middle East conflict. These are the ambitions and the intentions selected by a number of elite officials that is causing the world suffering at the moment. Now, from an internal perspective, in terms of what can be managed in Ireland, to remove all accountability from the government, I think would be a great oversight, and saying that they have no control over the country suffering in relation to fuel prices and home heating oil. I work part-time in a petrol station, and the number one complaint I hear is, like, when is that man Trump going to end his involvement in the Middle East? When is this going to end? And on the other hand, what I don't hear enough of, in my opinion, what steps the government has taken to address this, because let's be honest, the government is stating that the fuel tax and the increased carbon tax, the money needed from that is required for Ireland's sustainability and green energy goals, and similarly to the overspend on healthcare budgets, that money is needed to go elsewhere. But there's no evidence of these projects taking place. And Ireland's, you can see it in the north with the likes of Loch Ness and elsewhere, Ireland's record on sustainability and tackling climate change is about as efficient as the rest of the world's, and the fact that it's pretty poor. So to say that fuel can't see a tax reduction, or an excise on fuel can't see a reduction to alleviate in the short term the pressures on Irish working families, then that's laughable to suggest.
There has to be a limit, though, because, you know, even, what is it, like 35 cent off the price of diesel with various government interventions, and now in many places it's €2.05. I mean, any government in any part of the world, surely there is a limit as to how much you can protect the population from global influences, isn't there? I mean, I don't know what that point is, but presumably you believe there are further interventions that could be had, Kian.
There definitely are short-term interventions that can be made that won't see a great denigration of the Irish economy, or that won't show appreciation to global economic matters, as you're referring to, Greg. In the short term, saving the average Irish motorist €5 to €50 per tank of fuel would be a great weight lifted off of people's backs. And to say that that couldn't be achieved over a 6-month period of time, or a 12-month period of time, is ridiculous.
But it is open-ended, you see. I mean, you're presuming that crisis in the Middle East will end in 6 or 12 months. I think we all kind of thought it was over a couple of months ago, and yet here we are. Even Trump now is denying that it's over.
One factor that's consistent in this is that it will be over when America ends its involvement in the Middle East.
I understand that, but that's out of our control.
That's the fact of the matter here, Greg. And what's being expected of the Irish people via Donald Trump and American economic policy and American military policy, and substantiated and upheld by this Fianna Fáil government, is that once again the working men and women in Ireland are being expected to foot the bill for the ambitions of the elites around the world.
All right.
And that to happen.
Seamus, obviously you're coming at this from a few angles. You know, I'm asking the question really as an individual or as a private citizen. You have to look at all of this too as a business person as well.
Yeah, well, I took a look before we came on here just to see, you know, what percentage of my cost base is linked to the cost of diesel. And it's basically 20% of all money we spend at Football Special goes either directly to diesel or goes to
transport. Thought there was a funny taste off it. Oh, right. Yeah. You mean transporting it. Okay, yeah.
And I think, I mean, and this kind of speaks to Cian's point, if the price stays elevated, then there will be a knock-on effect in that the price of Football Special is inevitably going to rise, which is going to make it more difficult for the consumer. The average punter whose car is now costing more to fill up is now going to have to pay more for Football Special, which is going to leave less in their pockets and so on and so forth. So I think it's really two-pronged. The government have two things. They have a short-term measure. Over 50% of the price of petrol and diesel is in taxes. So that is irrelevant to whatever wars are happening around the world. All right, so they could fix that. But on the other hand, 99% of goods in this country get transported on the roads, which means we're all acutely aware of the price of fuel going up. We could build railways. We could build all sorts of other transport routes, which would alleviate the pressure people have. So the fact that somebody living in Remelton can't, you know, has only a couple of buses a day, let Kenny get to work, means they actually have to drive. But if the government really wanted to invest to pay people less, to insulate people from the shock of fuel prices, they would just build better public transport.
Yeah, and that would actually meet many of the climate goals as well. So it's
100%.
You're pushing an open door, aren't you?
100%. And also, you know, Cian is 100% correct. Where is this carbon tax going? There has not been one offshore wind farm opened up in the last 15 years.
Well, I mean, the details are there. It's supposed to be ring-fenced, but I think there's 200-odd million that is unaccountable for. But there has, some of it has gone towards retrofitting and what have you. It hasn't all been spent, but that was the idea. But as I say, I also know that there is a certain amount that's, I think it's around 200 million that's unaccounted for in terms of spending on that.
I'm sort of not even saying there's any sort of grand conspiracy here. There definitely is. I mean, we can see they're spending money on retrofitting because there are solar panels popping up in people's houses all over the place. But that is really nibbling around the edges here. We haven't got a high-speed rail network. We still don't have a train in Donegal. We have a massive government surplus. You know, equally, the government could take our massive surplus that they have and say, we're actually going to buy up, and, you know, 10 million barrels of oil. We're going to sit it in Ireland. We're going to keep it. We stopped building. We decided we weren't going to build a natural gas terminal, so we can't now store any gas. Mm. You know, it's like the government. It's easy for them to say, "Well, sure, what can we do when the Strait of Hormuz is closed?" Well, there's actually quite a lot you can do. There's nothing you can do about that directly, but there's a lot you can do to make Ireland not be so reliant on that.
Well, I mean, there's also too, we have to recognise, because of the amount of money involved, an awful lot of efforts going on behind the scenes to reroute oil out of that strait and find different ways of getting it to where it needs to be. But that's going to be
It's still a long way from Ireland, and it's still a long way from the West Coast, and we should still be trying to say, well, how else can we do things in this country? I mean, if you bring a shipping container from the East Coast of the United States into Dublin Port, it'll cost you about 50% again to get that from Dublin to Donegal. Now, how is that really, like, that is, you know, but in other countries, they have rail that takes this stuff from port to terminal. We have no rails. Everything has to go on the road.
Try banning the production of peat and then taking it in on containers from Eastern Europe. We're doing that.
Greg, you're sounding like a Healy Ray here.
Well, it's just the truth. I'm only spitting facts here, Seamus. Cathy, because, like, we all want to have everything really, really cheap, but there is also, you know, a global situation and the reality that a government, any government, has to bring money in to pay for the services we've been complaining about, i.e. health, etc. But anyway, you break it down for us, Cathy.
Well, you know, it's funny, it's a real case, as Cian has outlined, this sort of global and militaristic situation actually has such a knock-on impact on all of us. I mean, my fuel gauge never seems to get anywhere near half full these days. I just seem to spend my time just going, I'm not out of diesel again. The light just keeps coming on. It just seems to be just constant at the minute. The other thing is, we are just in September now, you know, early days of September. It's still warm. I think this crux, if this situation in the Middle East continues and we head into the winter months and, you know, people start, you know, trying to get a fill of home heating oil, then, you know, it really, really starts to bite, because also we need, you know, to make electricity, we need gas. You know, we need, you know, there's so many knock on effects here.
200,000 children in poverty. So in their households, the oil tank is not getting filled. The car is lying up outside the house if they're lucky enough to have one.
And as well as that, Greg, we know that so many people are in arrears on their electricity. How do they ever get back on track? The figures are kind of astronomical at this stage. I just don't know how people are supposed to cope now with all of these extra costs. Then you have the public sector union saying, you know what, we need more money to keep up with the cost of living. So there's this kind of wheel that gets set in motion that I this winter could get really tight. That's how I see it.
All right, okay, just a quickie, because we might not have to worry about it in 10 years. AI researchers like Jacob Coxon has walked away. He walked away from Anthropic, warning that the industry is racing towards self-improved superintelligence and gambling with human lives by the end of the decade. He's of the view that if things keep going the way they are, that these superhuman computers could eventually evolve to destroy humanity in its entirety in a decade. He could just be a bit... He could be... just exaggerating things. How concerned are you about things like this Terminator coming into reality, Seamus, briefly in a minute?
Not that concerned. I'm more concerned because there lots of things are going to get me before then. And, you know, there are what we definitely need regulation. And I often think about, we talked before about how the social media companies can't age police people, and how could they possibly do it, even though every single pub in the country is age policing. So, and there has been age rules on alcohol since the 1700s. So the government does need to regulate this stuff better, but I'm not, I'll be gone, I think, before Terminator comes out of the ground.
I'm not sure. Well, don't forget this time travel. We could bring you back and punish you then. Cian, how concerned are you? I think we don't really understand people like Jacob Coxon does. You know, when you have a program that thinks far more advanced than we could, that ends up wanting to survive, that has access to the world, you know, via fiber optic cables, etc. Is this just sci-fi, or is it something that you're concerned about?
Oh, it's absolutely something I'm concerned about, Greg. And I think as well, you're talking about the industry as well, and the people who work within it. The Irish Times, and not to be neglecting the Irish Independent, Cathy, the Irish Times released a article yesterday talking about workers within AI. And companies who specialize in AI production and that form of computer generated technology. And they said that most of the workers felt that it was a positive step forward in terms of human innovation, but only 41% of them felt that they had been given adequate training as to how to employ their newly formed AI skills. And I think that says a lot in terms of how this is being employed, not only as an invention, but as a tool in terms of how companies rival each other, in terms of how smear campaigns can be whipped up overnight. Cathy mentioned it earlier on. People believe what they want to believe, and AI is a tool that can tap into that and utilize areas that where people are ill-informed and promote information that is inaccurate. And as well as that, it's an invention that removes all form of human involvement, all form of human innovation. And it's ironic because this in itself is an innovative invention. AI is innovative, yet it removes all form of human responsibility and human involvement in terms of means of production.
Cathy, Cian. Cathy, in a minute, how concerned are you?
I'm absolutely very concerned about this. I'm really, really worried about it. I think it's a matter of time until it starts stealing jobs. Like, I write for a living. I really, really try. I mean, I'm not a Luddite, but I think opening that Pandora's box is tricky when you're in a creative industry, right? That's the first thing. But if you look at the background to what some of these things do, I thought I was reading about, you know, that Will Smith film, like iRobot, where they take over, right? But no, this is real. This is happening right now, where, you know, bots, they systematically collaborated in a way that was devious to override a system in an infrastructure company in the US called Hugging Face. I don't know what it means, but they coalesced into a kind of a renegade army. They hacked and they got into the systems behind this company. Now, this is so super intelligent that it could hack into anything. There's systems being developed that can take your phone.
My concern is that the nuclear weapons are on these same networks. Okay, right. Listen, let's hope it's not like that. Kathy, thank you so very much. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you very much indeed. Look after yourself. Kian O'Hagan, thank you for your time. Look after yourself. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Greg. You too.
And Seamus, thank you very much indeed. Have a goodie.
Cheers. Thanks,
Greg. And we'll chat to you real soon. Okay. Thanks for all your comments coming in. Thanks also to Kian, Kathy, and Seamus as well. On the issue of artificial intelligence, Equalis says AI cannot stop whilst the capitalist corporation control it. And US and China race to make it the most effective and lethal weapon of war ever. AI experts have got to the point where they do not understand how it works. And by the time they do, it's too late and the damage is done. It is now out of control. The reality being it is more intelligent already than we are. On value-related tax, Donegal probably has the highest counties with vans, etc. as public transport is limited. Where does the VRT on those vehicles be spent? Carbon tax, yet they're buying up data centres, which are worse for the environment than we are doing as people. But they're getting off scot-free and even getting tax breaks to build them. Also, people can have funny AI cat videos made, which makes you wonder, is global warming not a thing anymore? Or is it just a way to scam most people into paying? I think people have their minds made up at this stage and they either believe global warming is the thing or they choose not to believe it. And I don't think anyone's minds are going to be changed at this point. Greg, I read that Ireland doesn't import oil from the Middle East or deal with the Strait of Hormuz. Can you explain why it's affecting us? Well, neither does the United States, but it's a global market. The United States actually imports very little oil from the Middle East, but it's all part of the global supply. And then there is how much of it's available, how much it is per barrel, the difference in the strength of various currencies, then obviously the tax and VAT that's applied in any individual country. It's complex. The government set out in the budget last year to collect money from fuel and climate-related measures. Because prices went up, they gave us some relief and they put it back on at every chance they got. But as it stands now, they're collecting more than they thought they would because prices have gone up. That's the 23% VAT on the total charge. They've exceeded the amount they plan to collect and continue to exceed it. Another. So how can the Irish government give millions to Ukraine and charge its people disgusting prices for fuel and everything else? They're the scum of this earth. The one thing I'll say, and I'll say it again, we have an overseas aid budget that if we didn't spend, that would end up really not having any material impact on your day-to-day lives because the money actually, compared to the wider scale of things, is tiny. So say, for an example, just on health, the baseline figure spend is 27.7 billion and our entire overseas aid budget was under 800 million. 800 million sounds like a lot, but you can see you throw that into the health system. Do you think you'd have any better health system? I don't know. And then, you know, there is this historical thing that we do where we look after ourselves and try and look after others as well. But again, it's up to people to think what they think. My friend's daughter did an interview for the hospital recently. She came second in the panel, but she was told that the jobs were gone. She ended up working in Derry. For a young working local girl, it's a disgrace. The unions were told that if people wanted to work in the new hospital, they would have to do an interview. And I have that one. Right, okay, so just to let you know, by the way, we've got a wonderful loyal listenership to the Greg Hughes podcast. It's something we launched at the start of the year and we're 40, 50 episodes in at this stage and we've interviewed some amazing people and we've got some amazing interviews to come. If you haven't listened to it but you like your podcast, please give it a try. You will find it on Highland Radio's website every morning on a Friday at 11 a.m. And it's also in all the back catalogues available for you on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And as I say, some really interesting conversations. And this week's guest, well, he's been a staple of Irish broadcasting and a familiar face on our screens for decades. But how did Niall McCarrickey actually land his icon role on Rosneroom? Well, on this week's podcast, we sit down for a broad chat covering everything from his life in acting and the evolution of the Irish language in media to the moments that have shaped his life and career, including the exact opportunity that gave him his big break on T.G. Cathair. Have a listen to this.
Well, when T.G. Cathair started in, we'll say in 96, there'll be 30 years now. When they started, I was doing a year or two before that, I did a pilot program called See You Burn, and it was about a comedy about undertakers. So they commissioned.
Hold on a second. See You Burn. Was that the name of the undertakers?
It was. Well, they opened a crematorium, so it was See You Burn.
Sorry, he caught me on the hop there. Go on. All right. So I had that ever made? That's all I want to know. Okay.
And it was very successful when T.G. Cathair started. Yeah. So we have actually I'm thinking of doing the follow up to it now. I'm going to have See You Burn and Son. They're going to be the first solar powered crematorium in the world. But that series worked. And we kept with writing comedy. So myself and Shane McGinley, God rest him, the two of us were writing comedy here. We did See You Burn, Lee na Gréine, FFC, Glan Cowell. We did four. Well, I left after the beginning of FFC. So we had done maybe 40 or 50 half-hour programmes of comedy. And with the last series, I was really finding it difficult and it was not a pleasure anymore. Lots of difficulties in, how will I put it? We had 12 programmes to do on a certain comedy. And it wasn't a pleasure anymore. Things were...
Was it artistic differences, time pressures?
It was...
Are you trying to be careful with your language have you not figured it out?
I figured it out.
Okay, I got you.
I'm trying to be...
Diplomatic.
Okay. We had problems. So after six programmes was done, myself and Shane decided, right, life... There's more to life than this.
Wasn't a pleasure any longer.
So we left the other six programmes. We didn't do them. So I was down editing and I met the series producer of Ross na Ruin. And if he had asked me a couple of months beforehand, I would have known. I wanted to keep doing what I was doing. Mm. But I was so, we'll say, fed up. And he asked me, would I go into Ross na Ruin? I said, yeah, probably would like to give it a try. So it was going to be for 5 weeks. And but when the contract came out, there was 15 weeks in it. And I said, right, there's no difference between 5 weeks and 15. It would be the same. And when the 15 weeks were up, I thought that was it. So, but just I saw the scripts coming out for the following two weeks. And I was there and I said, listen, hold on, I'm finished. Well, we always give more weeks than your contract, and at the end of the season, I was asked, "Would you want to come back next year?" I said, "Yes," because I had got used to just acting, like when we were doing it ourselves. We were doing everything,
but the regular income must have been attractive as well.
Well, we were not too bad the way because you know the irregular income was before we started.
I guess you understood, right? So there's a bit of stability there.
Yeah, but if we were to lift your cup and leave it down again, and you know, then they went to, you were going for another scene, somebody would make sure the cup was in exactly the right place. Yeah. Continuity. Mm. If you were to move a chair or a table, up until then, we would do it ourselves.
Yeah.
But now, all of a sudden, everything was handed to you. Mm. And I thought, life is very easy here.
But before I pick up from that, just back into your sort of creativity and how your writing relationship ended. Did it put you off writing for a bit in, you know what I mean? And, yeah. And then the Rosner an opportunity came in at the right time. Like, did it sicken you?
Actually, no, it didn't. Okay. I still wanted to write, and writing is still important to me. At the moment, I am writing a little sketch. It's for the night at the Oscars or the Banks Goes to Hollywood, one of these, you know, fundraisers for the local football club. But they want to know what sketch I'm doing. When it was announced a week ago, I said I was writing an Irish version of 50 Shades of Grey. And not everybody believed me. And of course, I can say today that it's not true.
Well, I was at one of those Oscars down for Neve Breach, those Oscar nights, and they're fantastic. And and I'll tell you one thing, there's a couple of them were pretty saucy, so nothing would surprise me.
I think, well, I didn't advertise the auditions, but there was very little uptake in general.
I can imagine. No, and listen, I meant when I asked about the hiatus from writing, whether it was short-lived at that time,
no,
because you've been prolific throughout your career alongside Rosner. It's just sometimes when you have a bad experience, you want to step back and go.
No, I still love writing, although it is very, very hard. It is writing is actually the hardest part.
Mm.
And if you have a day, writing for a day, if you're writing, and we used to spend quite a good lot of days writing, but you would be more tired in the evening than you would be if you were out on a 12-day shoot, a very hard day. Writing takes a lot more out of you. You will be totally drained, especially if things are going well. And myself and Shane were actually very, very, how would I say, on the exact same wavelength.
Yeah, yeah.
And somebody would start off the, you know, conversation, what are we going to do here, right? And then we'd come to a block of some sort, and we'd be sitting there maybe for 2 hours, and nobody could get round this block. And then we'd decide, right, we'll go home. And on the way home, either I would ring him or he would ring me with the solution. So it was just take a break and
you'd find a way. So the 5 weeks became 15, and the 15 become season two, and then this is John Joe Daly's emergence into popular culture. What was it like in those early years going into the second season, and what level of certainty do you have going forward? Because the character's been on our screens for over two decades now. But
you don't have any.
Really? Yeah.
The bottom line is you don't have any. At the end of every season, you're asked, well, you may be asked, do you want to come back? And that still goes on.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, I would think to myself, "Jesus, what's going to happen now if I'm not back asked back next year?"
Yes.
And eventually, I got kind of, we'll say, maybe used to it, and I would be thinking, "Right, if I'm not asked back, I have other things I can do."
There you have it. That's just a taste of what's in store. You can listen to the full conversation with a wonderful gentleman in Niall McCarkey on the Greg Hughes podcast, available today from 11 a.m. on Spotify, Apple Tunes, or wherever you get your shows, and of course on the Highland Radio website, and you can watch it too on YouTube. Just a text coming in there. Greg, See You Burn was so funny, you have to see it. Indeed, and Shannon said the same thing. I haven't seen it, and that's on me, so I'll definitely have to have a look at that. And hi, Greg, we love your show and tune in every day. Just listening to the chat about AI, and it's all so negative. Don't forget we've got God and our Father above to look after us too, and there's nothing artificial about him. Indeed. Yeah, okay. Well, until artificial intelligence sees him as a threat. Okay. And another person on social say AI is only useful by the input it's given. Yes, indeed. That's our AI. That's what we use. That's the commercial element of it. But we're talking about the super intelligent sort of self-thinking AI. Right. So Irish Music Month is back again for this September. And as part of Highland Radio, Highland Radio has been on the search for a new local hero. So we got I think it was over. It was certainly, it was very close to 100 submissions of super artists from right across the region and beyond, but right across the region. And there was a team of us that had a job of trying to whittle it down to four finalists. And let me tell you right now, it was not easy. And there are artists that unfortunately didn't make the final four that are going to go on and continue to have great success in their careers. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But what this is about, what the Irish Music Month is about, is selecting four artists. And each of these four acts will now receive €650 plus an allowance of €225 for their technical crew. So that's €875 each of these four have already won, which is fantastic. And that's because they're going to come in next week to perform live on this show. And then a mixture of judges and listeners votes. We will select one winner from that four who goes forward to the national for national consideration. So the 21 entries then are judged on their winning performance interview at the end of September. So next week, really important for us to get a winner. I'd love to see us win this one. Now, there is an overall prize as well. Well, I'll get to that. Of those 21, there's a short list of six chosen for the grand finale, a national event, and announced later this month. And if our winner is selected as one of the six, they receive a further €1,000 plus €400 in expenses. And then the new local hero, and we really hope it's going to be one of our four, if they win the overall prize, they get an additional £5,000 in prize money, €5,000 in recording time, a single released by Ruby Works label, and extensive radio support across the 21 independent radio stations. And then the finally edited audio from the final national broadcast is a 1 hour special. Right, so let's give you an opportunity now to hear just a snippet of our finalists. So first up, Killian McLaughlin, who by chance was a guest on this show not too long ago. He's a 20-year-old singer-songwriter from Newtown Cunningham and is currently entering his third year studying commercial and modern music at BIMM University in Dublin. And his second single, Peace of Mind, is about being a little dopey or forgetful at times while still remembering the people and moments that matter most in life, having grown up in Donegal and spent many summers enjoying drives along its road. It's Rhodes. Here's a bit of Killian's track, Peace of Mind. Yes, he can't forget about us. Killian, he's one of our four finalists. The second finalists are The Hopeful Kind, another group that we've had on this show. They're a female-led indie pop band, Cara and Ruth, and the group released their debut single, Wherever You Go, in 24, with early support for the song coming from us here, 2FM and others. They've since released a number of singles, receiving national radio play, playing venues like the Academy Whelans, Bloom at the Phoenix Park Club, Club EO at Leo's Tavern, and also the Ghostlight Sessions in the Bala Arts Theatre. The song they submitted and the song that was selected is this. This is called Green Baby Go.
I could hit the brakes, I could fill my head with dolls, but with you, babe, that's out the question, cause I know what we're all about. And I'm not in a rush, but keep on digging if it's gold. What's the good in finding magic? If you don't use it, then you should let it go.
Ryan McCauley, he's our third finalist. He's an up-and-coming musician from Donegal. Ryan's determined to turn music into his career. He started posting on TikTok last year and completely unexpectedly built up a following of over 85,000 people through his music. He recently released his single Nickname and this year was incredibly lucky to perform on the main stage at Electric Picnic after being selected for a performance alongside some huge names, including Tiny Temper. And the track he submitted, and the track that got him into the last four, is Nickname.
You call me by my nickname, never by my real name. Give me a good reason I should never go back. told me I'm lying on the phone, now you're crying. The state of my mind, it'll never unwrap. You told me that I'm wrong and I said you're always right. I go back and forth in the middle of the night. Same old fight, same goodbye, say my name. It doesn't feel the same, oh no.
And our final finalist, Ruby Rua. They're a duo that is a captivating study in delicate contrast. In the background is Sebastian Kalka, a classically trained instrumentalist, director and producer with a lifetime of experience across musical genres. Sebastian weaves intricate acoustic tapestries that honour the philosophy that less is truly more. In the centre of the project stands Michaela Boner, a vocalist whose voice, haunting, precise and remarkably warm, has earned her the title of the Celtic Adele from those who have witnessed the duo's intimate sit-down performances. The track they submitted was Breathless, and this got them into the final four. So there you have it, our final four, the amazing Ruby Rua, Ryan McCauley, brilliant, the hopeful kind, who's superb, and Killian McLaughlin, who is a rising star. What a selection. We're going to hear them live. They're going to perform two tracks for us. We're going to have them in Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. They're going to perform two tracks, including the track that got them into the final four here in Highland Radio. And then we will select one that will go on to represent us in the national final and hopefully make the final six and make it on to the big show right at the end of this process. So there you have it. Killian McLaughlin, the hopeful kind, Ryan McCauley, Ruby Rua, all live, 10:30, next Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday. We're going to have a good chat with them, hear them perform live. In fact, as we speak, Oisin Kelly is out there prepping the studio for those live performances. Okay, so we're continuing our remembrance now of 9/11, 25 years ago today. Paul McCormick is a former NYPD officer, originally from Donegal. Paul, thank you very much for joining us. It's greatly appreciated.
Yes, good morning, Greg. How
are
you doing?
I'm all right. And how are you? Because I presume, Paul, having been so directly affected and involved in this, it might seem like a lifetime ago, but also it might seem like yesterday.
That is well put. That's exactly how it feels. I've been in New York for a few weeks now with a lot of 9/11 commemoration stuff. I was in New York and Texas last week in Midland, Texas. We had a 25th anniversary commemoration there. And like yesterday, we had a huge commemoration at the New York City Fire Museum and an event up at the rooftop of Penn Station, number 2 Penn Plaza last night, with the memorial beams as the backdrop. It was a it's surreal, to be honest with you. As you said, it seems like so long ago, but it just seems like yesterday too. And it's a very, you know, it's a sad time, but it's still a time to remember. And you know, we're glad to be able to do that.
Yeah, indeed. And only last week I was speaking to five firefighters from Ireland heading over to remember, just as you mentioned, and taking part in a fundraising cycle, because there is the incident on the day, the terrible loss of life amongst civilians and also the fire department and other emergency responders, but also then subsequently a large number that have died because they were poisoned effectively in fighting to save people's lives. Paul, you know, how do you reflect on it, or what are your memories of it? Because, and this is not in any way to, because it must have been like being on a, all the training in the world will not create you for the visuals of this. Two of the most iconic buildings in the world, massive, reaching into the skies, ablaze, being hit. Like Hollywood couldn't create it, if you know what I mean, visually. And yet you and your colleagues were there on the ground having to go in there and try and save lives.
Yeah, it's actually, anybody that went to New York, lived or worked in New York before the towers fell, when you were in Lower Manhattan, you would always use the towers as your guide for where you were and how to get around down in Lower Manhattan. And on the 11th, going down after the towers fell, after it, going down to the city and them not being there was like, it was like losing a family member. It's hard to explain. It was a sickening loss. And like, I remember the first, when I got there the very first time, to see the amount, the mountain of devastation that was there, the mountain of rubble and crushed concrete and steel. It was breathtaking. The devastation was breathtaking. But, and I remember thinking, my God, we're never going to get this. We're never going to get out of this. And, but what I'll tell you is the city and the country came together in a way that was something to behold. And I was so, so proud to be a part of it. I was so proud to be a member of the NYPD, to be a New Yorker and an American at the time, because our country came together in a way that, and it's sad that it takes a tragedy of that scale to bring a country together like that, because I haven't felt the same before or since then. It was a fleeting thing where we felt like the world's divided right now. There's a lot of anger, people can't talk to each other, but No, there was none of that nonsense back then. People were coming from all over the country. Police officers, firefighters were driving in from California, Chicago, to do anything to help. Mm. I remember Chicago guys with the checkerboard hats were directing traffic in Times Square. It was unbelievable, the response, and every company in the country were sending in supplies to us. It was just incredible. And as cops, Greg, it's really, really tough being a cop at the best of times, because you're responding to the negative things in life. But when we were driving down from the Bronx to Manhattan, the people were lined up in the streets cheering for us, handing us bottles of water, and it was something that I remember was one of my biggest memories from that, was the way the country came together.
People like me, completely removed, reflect on this sort of as observers. But I was speaking to some of your colleagues in the fire department last week as well that were there. And, you know, and I'm sure NYPD members were the same. They were being sent in to try and save people in the knowledge that they likely wouldn't come out. And you had commanders sending men and women up the stairs, knowing that they may not come out. But if you could get out, hopefully you'd bring someone with you. Like, just to be in that moment and know that you are putting your own life at risk, likely, is just, yeah. I can't put myself in that brain space.
It's just, well, that's what you do as a cop or firefighter. And we did a lot of remembering over the last few weeks. And, I was very proud back in July to open up an exhibition for Damien Meehan. Damien, his parents, Peg and Mike, from Donegal Town. And I think we'd half the Meehan clan came down from Donegal and Galway to Croke Park, where we opened up the exhibition for Damien, who played Gaelic football for the New York team. But Damien died, and, you know, Damien was working for a financial company on 9/11, and he happened to be above where the planes hit. And he couldn't make it out, but Damien's body was recovered. It was recovered with some firefighter bodies, which was of a comfort, I remember, to Mike, God rest him. And Damien had two brothers, Eugene and Kevin, that were in the FDNY, and a brother, Mike, that was in the NYPD. And, it's as you said, you know, the firefighters that went in, the cops that went in, it was such an Irish, you know, hit that was taken by a lot of Irish people. I mean, you speak to most people in Ireland, they know somebody or they have some connection to 9/11. And we have our 9/11 exhibition that we've been doing for 16 years. And we have the O'Rourke family, firefighter Kevin O'Rourke from Scotstown. The Michael Lynch from Tralee was a firefighter. Moira Smith. Moira was a police officer. Her father was from Dublin. And as you said, the last picture taken of Moira Smith was a picture. She was the only female officer from the NYPD killed in 9/11. But there's a very famous picture of her taking a guy with blood streaming down his face out of the South Tower. And right after she took him out, she went running back in again. And when the first tower fell, I remember being in my office in the 41st precinct in the South Bronx with my executive staff. And my most vivid recollection of 9/11 was when the first tower fell, a female police officer came over the radio, our police radio, calling for help. And that was Moira Smith, who was actually in the building, and she died in the building. Her body was recovered a few months later. But, you know, Jimmy, her husband's a retired cop. We have her personal effects and like her gun belt, her radio in the exhibition. And it's just, we're very proud to remember the sacrifice these first responders made.
And that's it. And it has sort of moved from, I'm not saying it's not still raw, don't get me wrong, but it has, from my conversations, and it includes this one, moved to sort of a celebration of those and a remembrance of those and pride in those that gave their lives on that day. We're in, I think enough time has passed where people have stepped into that space now, which is nice, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it is. It's like we'd rather remember the positive aspects, the heroic aspects, than the evil and negativity of it, and I'm glad it's turned that way, Greg, because it's important that we remember that. And you mentioned the Donegal cyclists that came out; they were actually at our event last night at on the roof of Penn Station at Number 2 Penn, and it's nice, it's lovely to see the you know, the Irish connection still. Like, Ireland held a National Day of Mourning. And the amount of love and support that we received from Ireland was really overwhelming at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that hasn't changed. I mean, it's like the, like, Donegal people are magnificent people, got huge hearts, and they do anything for you, give you the shirt off their back. And that's just seen throughout Ireland.
It's just interesting, though, in the police force and in the fire service as well, the family actually goes beyond the precinct or beyond the state or beyond the country. It's a global. Paul, thank you so very much for joining us to help us remember. And everyone, I think, is remembering in their own way. And we appreciate your time. I know it's been a busy couple of weeks, but a lot of it is very positive work in the work that you've been doing in opening and speaking and remembering. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks. God bless everybody.
Look after yourself. That's Paul McCormack speaking to us from New York, former NYPD officer, of course, from Donegal. And his brother Peter was associated with those events as well, of course. Now, I heard amazing things about the last big event Highland put on in terms of the bingo party. And it is back. It is back, isn't it, Corinne? Joins us now to launch it. How are you getting on?
I'm good, yeah.
Okay, so the Big Highland Radio Bingo Party is back, and this year, yes, I'm making it even bigger.
We're going on tour. We're going on tour.
That's fantastic, right? Tell me more.
We are taking it to two locations this year. So we're going back to Balbuffet, to the Villa Rose, and we are also going to the Inishowen Gateway Hotel in Buncrana.
Mm-hmm.
So over two weekends, so we have Saturday the 21st of November, we are in the Inishowen Gateway in Buncrana, and then Saturday the 28th of November, we're back in the Villa Rose.
So I heard amazing things about the first event, that it was, it's one of those ones, isn't it, that it's hard to sort of describe in advance, but we've got one in the bag now, right?
Exactly.
So we've seen what it's like, people know the crack that can mm-hmm. be had. So it makes it getting the message out there easier, doesn't
easier.
It?
Easier. Like yeah. last year, I think people didn't know what to expect.
Which is good in a
which
way.
Which is good as well, yeah. But it was a great night. It really was a great night. So anyone that was at it last year, we're kind of inquiring this year again to sort of see where we're doing it. And then also we had the Boogie Bash earlier this year as well in the summer. So we had people at it that were kind of, you know, looking for something similar again. So if anyone was at the Boogie Bash, they would also enjoy this night as well. It's just a bit of crack. It's a bit of fun, good music, and that's...
And it's a good excuse to get your friends together, too.
Exactly.
I think that's part of it. You know, sometimes, you know, you say, oh, we must do that, or we must... You know what actually you need to do? Say, right, we're going to do this, and you book your tickets, and then it's
and
locked in.
And see these dates, right? Because I find, again, with my girls, like, trying to get a date in December is nearly impossible for a night out because there's just so much going on.
Mm.
So this is the perfect before the madness of December hits. Get your night out booked in for the end of November.
Right, so what happens on the night?
So, well, obviously, we've got bingo. We've got dance-offs.
But bingo with a difference.
Bingo with, it's musical bingo.
Okay.
So it is. It's musical bingo. And then it is dance-offs, lip syncs. We had a few surprises last year. We had Bad Santa make an appearance. So yes, he was quite a hit.
He always is, that fella.
He was definitely.
Have you booked him yet?
Not yet.
Right, you're not flagging, did you? I think he'll just turn up anyway. Don't book him.
He probably will, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just a night of fun, a wee bit of bingo. There's actually a top prize of €1,000 as well.
And the good thing about it is with these nights, you can be as big a part of it as you want. So you can be really involved in all the crack.
Exactly.
Or you can have fun and watch on and enjoy the crack. It's
exactly.
Something for everyone.
And there's people that come along that think they're just going to watch on, but then they end up.
I'd be one of them. I go, I'll just watch the Egypts. Food. And
then by the
end
of the night, there you are.
With my inflatable guitar, right? But that's what makes a good crack, isn't it?
That's what it is, yeah. All right. It's just good, clean fun. Like, that's...
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Nothing dirty in it at all.
Well,
man.
Until Bad Santa arrives into
that's
the
what I was thinking. I've seen
things
the
go a bit crazy. But
right, Saturday the 21st of November and Saturday the 28th of November. Now,
yes.
They're not Christmas themed per se, but are we in sort of Christmas party season as
the
well?
The 28th of November will be hitting a wee bit of the festive fun
say,
in that
yeah,
one.
Because
yeah,
because we're within the month and we're starting to feel...
Exactly. And also, I can't forget about our hosts for the night are Lee Gooch and Keith Fletcher as last year, and we'll have Marty Friel on the decks as well.
Brilliant.
So better not forget to mention them.
No, don't. I was going to anyway. And by the way, the bingo, it's not just bingo, it's fun bingo, extra fun bingo. Enough bingo is fun generally. But there's actually money up for grabs as well. The top prize is €1,000. So that's actually decent in and of itself. Lots of glow sticks, dance off, the lip sync battles, plenty of fun surprises and entertainment through the night. Organised chaos, right? So the team and you have it well organised.
Yeah.
But the whole idea too is that it feels like what's going to happen next.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. How much did you enjoy it? I know you'd be working at the same time, but comes a point whereby you've done all the spade work, you can kind of enjoy the buzz.
Yeah, like
as well.
Because last year was the first event and we were kind of, you know, you don't really know how it's going to go or how people are going to enjoy it. But once you see everyone getting involved and having a good time, you can kind of relax a bit then and, you know, enjoy it yourself.
Right, so Inishon Gateway Hotel, Buncrana. So if you heard the buzz, you saw the videos, but you thought, you know what, it's a bit far for me to travel, well, there's one right on your doorstep, pulling the crowds in from all over Inishon and south of that as well. That's on Saturday the 21st of November. And then on the 28th of November, back to the beautiful Villa Rose Hotel. Great friends of ours there in Bala Buffet. It's always a fantastic venue for us to do anything in. So all the fun you could expect. So it's a full night of entertainment. So it's not just sitting down playing bingo. There's a lot going on, and it's €30 per person. And we've got stuff too, glow sticks and other things.
Oh, there's loads of stuff.
Add
yeah,
to the
there's
fun,
loads
right?
of stuff. Yeah.
Did people dress up in theme? Do you know how people go to the darts and they might pick a theme? Or something. Or did people just glam up for a night out?
Because that was a festive night, we had some kind of Christmas parties there, so they were dressed up.
No 80s?
The Boogie Bash, now that was a different story.
Because I'm kind of conflating the two a little bit.
Yeah,
here in my mind.
The Boogie Bash, now we had a lot of people dressed up for that. They really, really got involved.
How do people get tickets?
So tickets are on highlandradio.com. I was trying to get them live there before, so they may be up now.
Fit that you threw when Gooch says, I wonder where they're up. Yeah, of course they're up. I'm in here since 7 o'clock, mate. And now...
I know, I've been on it all morning, but they're just... They should be. If not, they'll be on highlandradio.com and we'll share the link on our socials as well.
Listen, there's plenty of time. No, it's up. Well done. Even know how good you are.
No,
up there, yeah. Yes, you can get your tickets there. Perfect. Add it to your calendar. Super stuff. So that's live on the website. Go and get it now. I think what it'll do, there'll be a bit of ringing around, a bit of tagging and getting the group together.
And now just unlike the Boogie Bash, the tickets for the bingo are limited because we can only fit so many people.
Understood.
Because it's seated in tables. So the tickets will be limited. We have only a certain amount of people that we can fit in the room, and we did sell out the Villa Rose
last
year.
Don't be disappointed then. Get on the website and you get more details. Super stuff. Thanks so much, Corinne. How is the Lapland competition going? Because that's crazy.
That's
gone crazy, hasn't it?
Yeah, that has gone crazy.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Okay. Loads of entries on that. So it's going to be a fun day on the 25th.
Okay, that's where we leave it on the show. We'll be back with you on Monday morning at 9.